How is the demand not the most obvious thing on the planet?
Yeah, I mean, for me, the biggest excitement for Tesla or around Tesla is the humanoid robot. That is the end-all be-all as far as I'm concerned, as far as the future value of Tesla.
What Tesla is working on and the reason why it has the fan base it has and why it has the attention it has, it's because they've identified industries that are unbelievably ripe for disruption.
There's always opportunity in disruption. And I'm actually kind of surprised because Wall Street is constantly being disrupted. They've been disrupted in so many ways, and yet Wall Street has survived.
I wonder if Wall Street's just always destined to just always miss NVIDIA, always miss Tesla, always miss Palantir, Robinhood, Lemonade in some respects, Coinbase probably, right? I just really want to pick your brain a little bit about how you view the Tesla story, because I've seen your content on Herbert, right? I mean, you're in that format predominantly, but yeah. I don't think I've ever seen you in a more sort of open-ended sort of discussion as of late. So just kind of help me level set, like your broad view around the story, where you think it's going, and then just I'm going to pick your brain in a couple spots and see where it goes. Yeah.
Yeah, I mean, for me, the biggest excitement for Tesla or around Tesla is the humanoid robot. That is the end-all be-all as far as I'm concerned, as far as the future value of Tesla.
Yeah.
And I sort of feel like a lot of us, we kind of stumbled into that understanding over a period of time. And for me, it was aided by essentially some comments by Elon on some of the posts that I'd made a couple of years ago. And James Dalma had also commented on my post. And so I was like, huh. If these two guys kind of are agreeing with what I'm putting out there, then maybe I'm onto something.
Yeah.
And so that was very encouraging. But, and then second to that, I think obviously it's robotaxi.
Before robotaxi. So what were those posts specifically for the audience in case they're not familiar?
Yeah. So the one, I did a post on, sort of the potential, unit economic model for the humanoid robot. What does the profit per bot look like once they're at a certain scale, right? Once they're making X millions of these a month or a year, what does it look like? What do the economics of the robot look like? And just the favorable response that I got from Elon on some of those posts really kind of indicated to me that I was onto something. And again, it wasn't just me. That was the whole community, but I was sort of a part of that effort and trying to understand what this might look like.
And then your background allowed you to do that? Like, so how did you arrive to those models? Like what made you land those models?
Yeah, that's a good question as far as that. I mean, I've been a financial advisor for 30 years. The models were built in Excel. I've been using Excel my entire professional career. So I guess just my Excel skills and just being able to put, you know, a spreadsheet together and plug in a bunch of numbers and see what the output is. It's really as simple as that.
Yeah.
Right.
Yeah.
And then testing those ideas with different people and getting feedback and then tweaking the model. Particularly with the robotaxi model that I did, that actually got James Dalma's attention. And he reposted it with some comments. And Elon responded to James and he said simply, "You understand, but you do."
Mm.
And again, that was enough for me to say, maybe my unit economic model here, maybe I'm onto something here, right? Yeah. If Elon is simply saying that you guys get it.
And so this is actually very interesting because I've done my own modeling over time. You know, I started modeling Tesla financials, Tesla sales, sort of their different verticals that we're building for years now. And the first 99% of time until it becomes a reality, it's just a constant stream of, "You're a fucking idiot. How are these numbers so big? Are you a lunatic?" Right? Do you get that level of like, because you know, let me sort of frame this way. I feel like what Tesla is working on and the reason why it has the fan base it has and why it has the attention it has, it's because they've identified industries that are unbelievably ripe for disruption that if done correctly, open up incredibly gigantic TAMs. And for some reason in this country or just society is incapable of visualizing that could actually be reality.
Right.
Even though we've had countless historical examples in the past of technologies that have come through and completely reinvented society, the railroad, the automobile, the printing press, right? Don't get like fire was the OG, okay? We've had insane technologies that come through and they just transform the world. So how do you view the sort of Musk sort of industry through that lens? What kind of lens do you use when you're thinking about the numbers that I'm sure your model spit out? And these are gigantic numbers, right? You're like, okay, like, can this even be real? So like, walk me through that thought process.
Yeah, it's been really interesting, Farzad, because a lot of people have accused me of all kinds of things and called me all kinds of names, even recently, you know, as yesterday.
Welcome to the club.
Right? It just continues, right?
It's fine.
And I've always maintained that I'm going to be completely wrong, but I think directionally we're right.
Yeah.
Right. My models, you know, throw out certain price targets and people like to focus on certain numbers. That's not why I'm building the model to generate a price target. It's just kind of an output from the model. I'm building the models to better understand the economic drivers of Tesla and what the opportunity might look like. And I always invite people to plug in their own numbers. While I don't share my underlying model, I share enough of my model so that people could build their own. It's not really that complicated, right? And I like to show that and have people think about this on their own and plug in their own numbers, test different assumptions and see what the output is. One of the big criticisms from traditional analysts, fund managers, we all know one in the community, I won't mention his name, that just doesn't—
Shout out Gary Black. He's my buddy, I love him. We discern everything, he's my buddy. Yeah.
And it's funny because I had some conversations with them before you blocked me about sort of what the future might look like, right, with the humanoid robot. And one of his fallback comments is always, well, where's your demand model? Where's the demand going to come from? And it's pretty hard to have a demand model for a product that doesn't yet exist.
Right.
Right. And so we've kind of reached this impasse between him saying, well, if it doesn't yet exist, there is no demand model, there is no value.
Okay.
Right.
Does that make you go crazy when you hear that? Like, does it make you go crazy? Because to me, it's like, I don't know if it's like something like my brain's wired a certain way, but when I hear that, I'm like, how is the demand not the most obvious thing on the planet?
Right.
Right?
Yeah. What's the demand model for Moore's Law? How can you model using demand that we're going to just increase compute, very, very consistently from the 1960s onward?
What do you think is the blockade there, CERN? Like, what's the thing that prevents that type of, like, is it just an absolute sort of like are they just beholden to having to have the number solidified for them to be able to model? Is it like just a total inadvertent, like, are they just afraid to project into the future the likeliest outcomes? Do they just not work with statistics? Like, what do you think that is?
I think the number one thing I would say is that Wall Street is very short-term focused, right? They will look out a year, maybe 2 years if you're lucky.
Yeah.
Right. And as we get to this point in the year, they're looking at 2026 numbers. Right. So definitely 18 months out. Right. And that's what Wall Street prices in. And if you're on Wall Street and you look out beyond that, you're not really going to be rewarded for that, because typically stock prices do not look out that far. Mm. And we've seen this time and time again with every single innovative company you can point a stick at. The last great example, I think, is NVIDIA. Jensen was very clear about the direction of that company and what was coming. No one listened to him. They were all worried about the sales of their gaming chip, right? And after COVID, there was a post-COVID decline. Stock lost a lot of money, right? And Jensen kept reminding us that this AI boom's coming right around the corner. And then all of a sudden, boom, it hit. And analysts spent the next couple of years chasing the stock.
Mm.
And I think the same thing is highly likely to happen to Tesla when they have that moment.
Yeah. And what's interesting about that, right? It's you know, I sometimes wonder, so Elon has a track record of being late, sometimes very late, but he's also correct on a lot of different variables, especially the big picture ones that are the most esoteric, Those are the ones that he usually lands dead on. Reusable rockets, profitable electric vehicles, mass market electric vehicles, brain chip, right? These are things that are just like, are hard to fathom at the time
ridiculous
when they get introduced.
Scales of batteries.
Ridiculous scales of batteries. Ridiculous scale of training compute. Ridiculous scale of self-driving vehicles, right? These are like almost insane things. And I wonder, like, you know, has there been a history of leaders, public CEOs that maybe have made promises and they've under-delivered or they've never delivered that has trained Wall Street to sort of like say, okay, well, we're not going to price it in until it happens. Or it could just be like a risk management thing, right? To your point, if these guys are modeling 6 to 18 months in the future and they are dealing with other people's money, by default, they're not going to properly come up with a model that is honest about the statistical likelihood of a huge upswing in a company's valuation because of what they're working on that's going to become real 5 years from now. So it's like they are just incongruent, right? Like those two things just don't play nice together. And so I wonder if Wall Street's just always destined to just always miss Nvidia, always miss Tesla, always miss Palantir, Robinhood, Lemonade in some respects, Coinbase probably, right? I think about that a lot. And it's like, that is one of the, you know, because again, like we talked about before, like I read the stuff that comes through. And of course, it's like, I always try to have like a system that says, okay, are you losing your mind? Are you losing your mind? Are you losing your mind? And the answer is always yes, but not in this respect. Yes, but you know, I am losing my mind, but not in this specific thing. So I don't know if that's something that you share and like something you run into as well. I'd love to hear your take on that. Thank you to the sponsor of this podcast, Rebellion Air. Now, we know a lot of you are Tesla fans, and especially Tesla investors. And if you have more than $1 million of Tesla stock, Rebellion Air could be the perfect fit for you. Rebellion Air is an investment firm that helps Tesla investors reach their financial goals. They do this by helping you plan for your future, and they also institute strategies like trimming and adding, covered calls, etc. So if you're somebody who believes that Tesla has long-term potential, these kinds of strategies could maximize the number of shares you have by the time Tesla reaches those goals. And the guys at Rebellion Air do this by doing so much research on the Tesla story, and they do a lot of novel research as well. Things like doing cross-country full self-driving trips to really gauge and truly understand the capability of that specific software. They've done really novel research around the energy side of the business and other parts of the business as well. And so instead of dealing with a typical investment firm that may give you the cold shoulder by viewing your investment as too risky, the guys at Rebellion Air will help you reach your goals while fully understanding the Tesla story. And so if you're a Tesla investor and you have more than $1 million of shares and you're interested in finding out more about Rebellion Air, I have a link for you in the description in the comment section below. You can go to rebellionair.com/Farzad, and that's how they'll know that we sent you. And now back to the podcast.
Yeah, I think there's always opportunity in disruption. And I'm actually kind of surprised because Wall Street is constantly being disrupted. They've been disrupted in so many ways, and yet Wall Street has survived. But you would think in this age of highly knowledgeable retail investors, right? I think particularly for Tesla and Palantir and some other companies, the retail community understands these companies better than the professional analyst community does.
Yeah.
Which is amazing. We've never seen that before. And then I would also say that there's some sort of non-traditional professionals out there now. And ARK Invest, I think, is probably the leading candidate in that space as far as it goes for Tesla.
Yeah.
And you would think in the face of those two forces that would wake up Wall Street and say, oh my gosh, we better mend our ways here and approach this a little differently. And yet we haven't really seen that yet. And so I don't know what that will take. But I guess eventually if they feel like enough of their turf is being taken, they're going to have to fight back in that way.
And you know, that's super interesting because that makes companies like Robinhood, as an example, their future probably looks extremely bright because the ultimate forcing function for Wall Street to really wake up is less money to invest, less fees being made from clients, right?
That's right.
If there's a flight away from your usual firms or whatever you want to call that are just not having the same returns as somebody with a Robinhood app and going on a forum and watching YouTube videos for 2 weeks straight and absorbing everything, and then having the diligence of like doing the DD and sitting down and making the investment and actually being patient and allowing the thesis to play out and constantly test the thesis every day, right? Like that's the retail. I feel like that's the retail playbook. Is like study for weeks to months potentially. Make sure you have everything you think you have figured out down pat. Make your investment, and then every day recheck the thesis. Is this still happening? Is this still happening? Still this is happening. And then you know you tell yourself, I am okay if I have to wait 5 years. I'm okay if I have to wait 10 years. But that requires the time to do the research, the patience, right, to actually like to actually see the story play out, and a lack of ego to constantly ask yourself, am I dumb? Did I just make a mistake? Right. And I think,
and the emotional regulation, not to freak out or get too excited, you know, either one.
Yeah.
Which I think is the hardest part for any investor. And I think that's partly why Wall Street tends to be, you know, fairly short-term focused. Because if you allow yourself to dream, then suddenly you can get yourself into trouble because you've dreamed so big, right? And you're a fund manager and you're at the end of the year saying, well, I had a bad year this year, but you know what? 5 years from now, it's going to be great. That's not really going to work well for your investors, for your own compensation, for the company that you work for. So because they're on that quarterly, annual kind of compensation scheme, they have to deliver results in those time periods.
So
whereas
how
retail
is it,
investors aren't constrained in that way.
How is it that Ron Barron has managed to kind of skirt that dynamic that you're talking about? Because he, you know, is one of the best fund managers on Wall Street. And at the same time, he does, you know, make some of those longer term investments and allows them to play out over time. Like, is it his fund construction to where different, like it's uncorrelated enough to where different things are winning at different times, so he's able to produce consistent results even when part of, you know, the investment thesis is taking longer to play out? Or does he have a different structure that allows him to, you know, just survive when the fund isn't performing as well as, you know, some other things? Or how does that work for someone like Ron Barron?
Yeah, the Barron Funds is a, you know, a mutual fund complex with a number of different funds, different strategies. So they're not all the funds are, you know, heavily invested in Tesla or, you know, other companies. They're very diversified. His fund family, his investment management company, has been around for a long time. I don't know how many years it is. It's been a very long time. And he's at the point now where I think a lot of the money is his own. And of course, he's also got a number of very patient, wealthy friends. And so I think it's just a combination of he's been in business so long, he's proved himself. People now give him the benefit of the doubt. They see his results. And, you know, I would say in the last decade, he's done some amazing things. But maybe for the first 30 years, he was kind of wandering in the woods, relatively speaking.
Yeah. Right. So it's like a combination of proven track record and then instilling a culture with your clients, right? So it's like usually you would think in a typical organization, the most successful ones, which I think is becoming a trend that sort of Elon, I think, has popularized, which is an existential mission is your best, like it's your best variable forcing function, whatever you want to use, to attract the best possible partners. Filter. Yep. The best to attract the best possible humans around you so you can actually execute against your goal. And I think in investing, if you're a firm, I feel like that would apply the same way. And probably that's why Barron is where he's at, right? His clients have the same culture as him, which is like, I trust you and I'm willing to wait as long as you think it's right. Right. And then let's go. And then that's very different than, you know, I guess it's very different from how usual firms were, which is like, I want this number go big. Why number no go big? Right? I feel like it's a much simpler thing. And it sort of removes the art, almost like the art and the work that's required to actually find investments that are life-changing in the future and actually like are make a huge impact to your ability to reach your financial goals and whatever. And I'm not trying to sell anything. I'm just like, I just think about this all the time, you know, because it is very interesting.
The other thing too, I think that Ron Baron and his team does exceptionally well is they recognize how important the leaders of these companies are. And so to my knowledge, you know, Ron Baron has been very successful in investing in companies like Charles Schwab, right? And that's been a long-term investment. And some of the gaming stocks and knowing some of the people behind those companies. And so he's very focused on the leadership of a company and he invests in people and less so, I think, the business. Right. And of course, that's a critical element for Elon. You know, I think, you know, as you said, as far as, you know, Elon has delivered longer term, he might miss some of the timelines. But if you're invested with a guy like that, over the long term, he's going to do exceptionally well. And I think Ron Baron's done an incredible job over the years of identifying other very successful business leaders. Whereas
across
I feel
a host
like a lot
of
Wall
industries.
Street focuses just on the numbers. And he's focused more on the people.
Yeah. Hans, you said across a host of industries, right?
Yeah. It's not just in tech or, you know, and I think that's one of the really important things, you know, either that's a superpower hack, you know, to be able to identify those different people across different disciplines. Like, you know, how do you check whether they're brilliant or actually just full of crap? If you aren't an industry expert in all of those things, I think that's, you know, something that's very difficult. He seems to have gotten that down pretty well.
And that's so fascinating, right? So like, just think about that for a second. A business or a public company is just a manifestation of its people. The people create the business. And so by default, the first principle approach to investing, you probably want to start with the people. Right. And so like, what kind of leader do you have? What kind of culture do you have? What kind of management team do you have? What kind of deliverables has your team executed against, you know? And so, you know, if I use that framing, if I'm going to invest in NVIDIA, it's because of Jensen. If Anduril goes public, I'm going to invest in it because of Palmer Luckey, right? Palantir is very attractive because of Alex Karp. You have these like singular leaders that are at the helm that are able to communicate unbelievable visions for their businesses. And then you do your due diligence. I'm like, okay, do the numbers match the vision? You know, is there execution against the vision? And that becomes, and it's just so fascinating, right? It's like invest in the people, not in the company. Which is the same thing, but I feel like that starts you at the right level of research instead of like just looking at the P&L, the balance sheet, which a lot of people do very successfully. You know, they might make their 10, 15% year over year CAGR, maybe 20% if you're unbelievable, right? But okay, how does that compare to 100x over 10 years or 1,000x over 10 years? You know, I think those are much more difficult to identify by default because it's really around the singular or person, individual, or teams. And those singular people and teams take a long time to bring that thing to fruition because that thing that they're working on is a very novel solution to a total addressable market that does not yet exist, but they can see the future of what it's going to look like. And everything they're putting in place aligns against their ability to execute to have that future become a reality. And it's finding those people that can do that, that I feel like sets a lot of these guys up for success.
Yeah, and I would just add too that Wall Street is full of people that have heard a lot of stories. And after hearing stories for decade upon decade, you get to the point where you've heard enough stories, right? And so Wall Street kind of operates under kind of a show me approach.
Yeah.
But again, I think that creates an arbitrage opportunity for more patient investors.
Yeah.
Investors with different incentives, the ones that don't need to be compensated quarterly or annually. It's just a different game, I think, that retail can play versus the professionals. And I think it's a great opportunity for investors.
Yeah. And the best times for retail to get into the market is during bear markets to maximize that arbitrage opportunity, because those stories in the bear market take the biggest hits, because in bear markets, everyone's risk off. And by default, those most transformational companies are most risk off during a bear market. Like the investor base wanting to put money in against those companies. Yeah. None of this is investment and financial advice. I should have said that at the start. Hans, did you want to hit something before we shift gears to everyone's favorite coin?
Yeah, well, so the one thing that I wanted to bring in here or ask you, Cern, on this topic, like you've got, there's A, exceptional people. But then I think, you know, one of the patterns that it seems like reoccurs with maybe a company like Amazon or Palantir, like for Amazon, hey, we're going to go sell books. Like it's an unsexy thing that it's going to be really hard. And no one really wants to do that. And because it's really hard and no one wants to do that, like you just get this kind of greenfield opportunity to build a whole new foundation for, you know, what does a company on the internet look like? Because, you know, either the little people don't want to do that because it's not fun. And everyone assumes that, oh, yeah, well, if you're ever successful, Barnes & Noble is just going to kill you. You know, for Palantir, it's, hey, let's go try and build software for the intelligence agencies and special forces that actually works for them on the battlefield at a time when literally everyone in tech hates the US government and doesn't want to do anything with them at all. For Tesla, you know, let's go build electric vehicles when no one wants to build electric vehicles. These things that are just these monumental feats that are super unpopular, and like you end up just, it seems like you go disappear in the wilderness for 5 years, 10 years, whatever. And then all of a sudden, you know, it's Mad Max, you know, coming out of the desert to overrun, you know, the stock market at some, you know, distant point in the future. Like, is that essential? Can you have, I guess, are there really these big type of retail successes that work well that don't have that dynamic?
I think it's highly unlikely. I think you're hitting on something that's super important here. I remember Jeff Bezos always telling investors and telling his team that he wanted them to go and invest in a new idea and invest in a new business. And they weren't expecting results for 3 to 5 years. Mm. He wanted them to take the time and properly invest in those ideas. Right. And they weren't going to be super critical about judging the success over any short period of time. And I think that's to your point about some of these world changing ideas. Right. If you're going to build an EV and do it right, it's going to take a while. It's going to take a lot of effort. You may not have much to show for it for a long time. You may not be making any money for a long time. But if you do it right, you can come out the other side of that big chasm with a business that no one can really compete against. And we've seen that with Amazon, we've seen that with Netflix, we've seen it with a host of other companies that went after some pretty big incumbents, right? And I think we're seeing that with Tesla on many fronts.
And I also think, too.
NVIDIA, like, too.
Yeah.
Yeah. And the amount of pain in executing that experiment is what creates your moat long-term, right? Because if it's very hard to do, And no one else is even trying to do it, but then you stumble upon an incredible opportunity that's super, super painful and difficult to do. And if you're successful, that is what creates your moat for years and decades, you know? Like Apple having a very useful touchscreen phone with an unbelievable ecosystem. Turns out that was very hard to do. But now, you know, I would make the argument others have caught up now because Apple stopped innovating. They stopped sort of continuing that experimentation process. You know, Apple is like the poster child for this. They were unbelievably good at what we just talked about, right? And then once they're like, okay, now it's all about profit maximization, get the supply chain right. Let's make sure we get the investor base happy. Let's just create unbelievable profits. Now we're seeing the repercussions from that. Just flop after flop after flop after flop, which is very disappointing. But because their ecosystem is like the ecosystem moat still lives on, I cannot leave Apple. Not because they're like, you know, they have a gun against my head. It's because it would be too painful. Because then I have to redo everything on a whatever, on a Microsoft or an Android or whatever a new platform is, right? So that really speaks to overcoming really difficult things, I feel like.
And I think as far as that, to your earlier point,
yeah,
you know what's changed at Apple is the people.
Yeah.
There you right? go. You have different people running the show now.
Yeah.
And they're highly capable and competent, but they're focused on different areas of the company, and you're seeing then different results of that.
Yeah.
Well,
they're maximizing the present.
Yeah.
Also, you know, second order repercussions of things that Steve Jobs actually instilled in the culture and the people when he was there that work with him at the head, but then when he's not there, you know, this was something that I was actually talking to Phil Beisel about, and he, you know, is a former Apple engineer, also founded the tech team at Rivian. And he said, you know, that at Apple, there are so many silos, and it, and Steve actually built it that way because he didn't want different people talking, you know, shop across the organization so that they could control the information that was getting out, so they could do their cool product reveals and everything, but also so that they could incubate lots of cool different things in lots of different places. And, you know, because they were in silos, that then you didn't have too much like coalescing around certain sets of ideas, and you could really facilitate lots of different cool seeds of things that might grow into something really big over time. And that works great while Steve is the CEO, but then when Steve's not the CEO anymore and you don't have that taste that's going into really pulling up these, whatever, the, like identifying whatever these seeds are of the next sets of innovation and fanning the flames and, you know, making them actually work. And, you know, Steve's part of that, you know, Johnny Ive was also a big part of that. Then yeah, it, like the, that structure that worked so well under that certain set of people, like as soon as you make a few key changes at the top of the organization, all of a sudden that actually, that structure becomes something that holds you back instead of allows you to, you know, do the next cool big thing.
Yeah.
Yeah. One of the interesting examples for me is Google. They weren't, they didn't invent internet search. In fact, they were late to the game. There were other players. Yahoo was a major search player, right? And basically what Google did was came up with a better way. They wanted to figure out which pages were important, and they came up with PageRank. And that basically, that idea basically launched them to where they are today. Now, they've done a lot along the way to protect their turf, doing the deal with Apple, for example, to make sure that they were the default search provider for iPhone was a critical part of their success today, and a few other things. So, you know, there is a place for good management, but at the end of the day, if you don't have innovation, you know, chances are you're not going to be around very long.
And what's interesting there too, it's like, it's not even just innovation. It's also like prioritizing the most important thing and knowing what that most important thing is. This is like, I wrote a post about a couple of days ago. It's, you know, I was just like, it was like a Sunday night or Saturday night. And I was just, you know, having chocolate and just relaxing. And then for some, this is, I mean, this, I'm really outing just how huge of a nerd I am. I was thinking about Tesla and SpaceX. I was just thinking about it. I'm like, oh, what these are like fascinating companies. And then I try to understand truly, it's like, okay, so if I'm Elon Musk, like how, like why are the cars so good? Like truly, why are they so good? And why are they so unbelievably successful at delivering on the most important things? And it just became very obvious. It's like those teams, and really these are just great companies, I feel like do this. They just know, they understand what are the most important things about the product, and they go all in. Right. And Elon has mentioned this, I believe, in the past multiple times, you know, so with a car, it's just make sure it's an unbelievable car. It drives really good. The entertainment is unbelievable. The interface is unbelievable. The feature set is unbelievable. The squeaks and rattles, not that important. We will figure it out. Yeah. People will bitch and moan. Who cares if they come in, if they go in the car and they have a smile on their face, you know, this was like a whole huge tagline from Elon. That's what's important. You know, the Starship program. It's like, yeah, we're going to blow it up 20 times, but just have it reuse on the chopsticks, and then we go to Mars, y'all. Like, don't worry about the other stuff. Just, it's like the singular focus about the most, the mission critical things. Mm-hmm. It's the thing that's most impressive to me. And I wonder, like, and again, it ties back to that first principles analysis. It's like there's a lot of work that goes into what are the most important things for this thing that I'm trying to create and put out into the world and sell, whatever, you know, how are you framing that? So it's just fascinating. Like it's really interesting just how first principles is such an unbelievable framework for everything, not just for physics, and I think that's something that Elon has sort of brought to the public. Whereas maybe before it was like intuitive thing for business leaders to do, like successful business leaders. But now I think we have a brand new generation that actually understands what first principles is and why it can be so useful in everything, investing, creating companies, being a good father, being a good parent, being a good husband, being a good driver, whatever. Like,
not that Elon's good at some of those.
No, you know, it's everybody has work to do and everything, you know? So anyway, I just find that very fascinating. Like, well, super, super fascinating.